among Muslim debaters like Ahmadinejad and Shabir Ali. It originated at the end of the 18th century, when the Age of Enlightenment began generating naturalistic theories to account for Jesus' apparent resurrection. Muslims like Mirza Ghulam Ahmad had added a theistic twist to it, making it more plausible that Jesus could survive crucifixion. The argument goes, if God can do the large miracle of raising Jesus from the dead, why can he not do the smaller miracle of keeping him alive on the cross? The swoon theory is not the original Muslim explanation for Jesus' apparent death, though, nor is it the majority view. Most Muslims believe the substitution theory. Early in Islamic history, it was argued that Jesus was substituted before being placed on the cross. Allah put Jesus' face on someone else, and that person was crucified in Jesus' place. This is how they interpreted the Quranic verse, Jesus was neither killed nor crucified, but so it appeared. The question naturally arises, who was killed in Jesus' place? Different people have been suggested. Some say it was a devout young volunteer who wanted the honor of dying for Jesus. Others say that when Simon of Cyrene carried the cross for Jesus, they crucified him instead. Yet others say that Allah put Jesus' face on Judas' body, for poetic justice. The last view seems to be the most popular today. Another majority view regards Jesus' ascension. The Quran teaches that Allah raised Jesus to himself, leading Muslims to believe in the ascension and eventual return of Jesus. So, like Christians, most Muslims are waiting for the return of the Messiah. Our Jamaat challenged this view, because Ahmad claimed to be the Messiah himself. Appealing to the Bible, he argued that the Jews were mistakenly awaiting for the return of Elijah from the sky. Jesus said John the Baptist was the return of Elijah. In the same way, the world was waiting for the return of Jesus, but Ahmad was he. Of course, I vehemently argued whatever my Jamaat had taught me, so I provided the swoon theory and the position that Jesus traveled to India, where he died at an old age instead of ascending. The more I shared my views, the more I felt confirmed in my faith, and the conversations occurred with increasing frequency when I realized no one had anything substantial to rebuff my views. I felt I had mastered half of the arguments I needed to be a good ambassador for Islam. I felt that the other half was going to be even easier to argue. And I was right. It was. Chapter 14. The Father is Greater Than Jesus. By the time I was in 10th grade, my personal life was changing significantly. I began to spend far more time with friends, both on the phone and at school during activities. I was much more concerned with my clothing, which Ami was still picking out for me. I started to ask Ami if I could wear contact lenses instead of glasses, in an effort to combat the nerd reputation that I had acquired. No success. The tug of Western culture was becoming difficult to resist. I was still not allowed to go to sleepovers, nor was I allowed to go to school dances. My friends and I had grown very close, and that made my absence from these events all the more difficult. But I still represented Islam proudly, especially when my beliefs were directly addressed, as they were one day while I was in Latin class. At Princess Anne High School, Latin was taught by two teachers, both of whom were thrilled when their students enjoyed the class. The teacher who taught Latin too, Mrs. Earls, was far more kind and lax with me than she ought to have been. I loved Latin, and I loved her class. But I was getting more and more mischievous by the day, goaded by lack of reprimand. I was the kind of student who forgot to do his homework quite often, and upon remembering a few hours before it was due, I would try to squeeze in a way to get it done. Mrs. Earle's class was right before Spanish, and I often did my Spanish homework while she was lecturing. I would hide my Spanish textbook under my Latin textbook, working on it whenever she turned her eyes to the chalkboard, thinking that she was oblivious. Halfway through the year, I realized she wasn't oblivious at all, just highly tolerant of my shenanigans. I was working on my Spanish homework on one of these occasions when the girl in front of me turned around and said, "Nabil, can I ask you something?" Her name was Betsy, and she was the outspoken Christian in our grade. Everyone knew she was an evangelical Christian, and she often stood up for her faith. Despite her kindness and desire to help others, she had a soft yet adamant demeanor that made the rest of us uneasy. We thought she was a bit loony. "Yeah, sure." I had no idea where this was going. Had she wanted a pencil, she wouldn't have asked to ask me something, she would have just asked for the pencil. Nor would I have been the one she'd ask, for that matter. I always forgot my pencils. She paused for a moment, steeling herself, before asking, "Do you know about Jesus?" Now I knew she was crazy. We were in the middle of Latin class. All the same, I immediately gained respect for her. Why had other Christians never asked me this question? They did think I needed Jesus to go to heaven, right? Were they content with letting me go to hell, or did they not really believe their faith? I considered how to approach my response in the present context. I looked up from my Spanish homework to assess the situation. Mrs. Earls had apparently stepped out for an indefinite period, and most of the students were chatting around us. I didn't know how far I wanted to go, because I know I could quickly get passionate and carried away, so I decided to keep my answers short. "Yes." Her eyes went wide. That was clearly not the answer she was expecting. "Really? What do you think about him?" "Well, I'm Muslim, right? Muslims believe that Jesus was sinless and born of the Virgin Mary. He cleansed the leprous, gave sight to the blind, and raised people from the dead. Jesus is the Messiah, the Word of God." Betsy was stunned. I must have gone off script because she didn't know where to go from there, so I proceeded for her. "But Jesus was not God. He was just a man." There. I had drawn the battle lines for her and waited to see how she went to war. "Wow, you know a lot more about Jesus than I thought. That's great. I believe a lot of the same things, but I don't agree completely. Would you mind if I shared my view?" She responded softly yet adamantly, employing the very sneaky maneuver of being herself. "Sure, go ahead." This was getting interesting. "Well, I don't know if you know, but I'm a Christian." "Yeah, I thought so," I smiled, thinking to myself. "The whole world knows you're Christian, Betsy." She beamed, genuinely happy that I knew she was a Christian. "We believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and that's very important to us. Because he was the Son of God, he had no sin, and was able to take our sins upon himself." Now, I had many problems with that statement, but I had already drawn the battle lines, so I stuck with the issue of Jesus' deity. I decided to take a concessionary approach. "Betsy, I don't think the Bible we have today is the Word of God. It's been changed too many times throughout history. But for now, let's just say I did think so. Where does Jesus say, 'I am God'?" Betsy thought for a moment. She didn't seem too troubled, but it was clear to me she couldn't remember him saying it. After an uncomfortable moment passed, which she seemed totally comfortable with, she said, "In John's Gospel, Jesus says, 'The Father and I are one.'" This was the one I expected her to go for, and I was ready. "Yeah, but also in John, Jesus prays for his disciples to be one, just as he is one with the Father. So he clarifies exactly what he means by one. He means unified in spirit and will. If he meant one, as in one being, would he be praying for his disciples to be one in the same way? He's not praying for the disciples to all become one being, is he?" "That's a good point," she said thoughtfully. "Good point. I was in the process of dismantling her worldview, and she was being congenial? Did this girl ever get agitated?" "Well, I can't think of it right now, but I'm sure it's there. I can look it up and get back to you." "I'd love for you to, Betsy, but you won't find anything. Jesus never said he was God," I argued. "He made the opposite quite clear to us. He felt the pangs of hunger, thirst, loneliness, and temptation. He cried and he bled. He didn't call himself the Son of God. He called himself the Son of Man. He was very obviously human." Betsy was nodding along. "Yes, I agree. Jesus is a man, and he is God too. How can someone be man and God? Man is mortal. God is immortal. Man is limited. God is infinite. Man is weak. God is omnipotent. To be man is to not be God, and to be God is to not be man." This seemed to give her some pause. She was off balance, so I decided to push a bit harder. "When Jesus went to Galilee, Mark's gospel tells us he could do no miracles. Not that he chose not to, but that he couldn't. Can God not do miracles? When a woman in the crowd touched him, he had no idea who it was. Would God not know something that simple?" After pausing to let her process, I continued. "When a man called him good, he said that he is not good, only God is good. He draws a distinction between himself and God. He does it again when he said he didn't know when the world will end, and that only God knows. He's making it very clear that he is not God." Betsy said nothing. She had not thought of this before. I decided it was time for the coup de grace. "Betsy, in case there is any question, in the Gospel of John, Jesus said, 'The Father is greater than I.' And I agree with Jesus. God is greater than he is. I think you ought to agree with him, too. Betsy didn't know what to say. I waited. Well, I don't know what to say. She was sticking with her signature maneuver. I'll tell you what. I'm going to look into these things. In the meantime, I'd like to invite you to a play at our church that I'm a part of. Would you like to come? Sure, sounds like fun. But I don't have a driver's license yet. Mind if my dad comes along? Of course not. Bring as many people as you'd like. Here's the information. Let me know what day you're coming when you get a chance. Betsy handed me a flyer for the event and smiled. I saw something behind the eyes of her smile that I hadn't seen in her before. She was agitated. I smiled back. Chapter 15. Heaven's Gates and Hell's Flames. I was very excited to be invited to a church. I had been to one before, a Catholic church, and I remember that day as an exciting, Latin-infused blur. Honestly, it was so confusing that I could not figure out why I had been invited. I recall that some of my friends were there, including Ben and his family, but they weren't Catholic either. At one point, while our row was standing, everyone started walking to the front to get something from the priest. I didn't know what to do, so I started going with them. Ben's mom grabbed my arm and sat me back down into my seat. Startled, I looked over at her, and she was emphatically shaking her head, no. The priest, who had been rather solemn until then, was trying to hold back a laugh. No one had told me Protestant churches were any different, so I was expecting something similar. To me, the sanctuary of First Baptist Norfolk looked like an auditorium of sorts. I guessed that all the church stuff happened elsewhere, but I couldn't see where. I sat with Abba in the balcony, toward the back. Even though neither of us knew what the play was about, Abba was glad I had accepted the invitation. He said it would have been rude not to, and that it was a good way to keep the door of conversation open with Betsy. He was proud of me for sharing my beliefs, and he was hoping to help me process the play we were about to see. The play was called Heaven's Gates and Hell's Flames, and it turned out to be a performance of the Christian salvation message. It was during the play that I learned Christians call this message the Gospel. I had thought that the word Gospel only referred to the four books about Jesus. Throughout the play, the message came across loud and clear. Accept Jesus as your Lord and you will go to heaven. Otherwise, you will go to hell. Different scenarios were performed, each one ending with someone's death and his reception into heaven or damnation to hell, based solely on whether he had accepted Jesus. The imagery in the play was not subtle. When someone was sent to hell, red and yellow lights flashed through the room. A thunderous cacophony played over the loudspeakers, and Satan came rampaging through the set, dragging the sinner off stage. On the other hand, if someone had accepted Jesus, he would be ushered by radiant angels into a bright door, ecstatic with joy. In the final scenario, a man was driving a car, and his passenger was talking to him about Jesus. The man said he had done many bad things and ignored God his whole life. The passenger was able to convince the driver that he was a sinner and needed Jesus, so the driver prayed a prayer. No sooner had he prayed than a terrible accident occurred. Both men died, dramatically depicted by turning off the lights. When the lights came back on, beautiful music was playing and the driver was escorted into heaven. I'm not sure if it was intentional, but it was ingenious to end the play with that scene right before we all got in our cars to drive home. We started our follow-up discussion as soon as we put on our seatbelts. Nabil, what did you think of the play? I think it was silly, Abba. They were obviously trying to play on people's fears and emotions. Yes, I agree, Berta. But sometimes that's not bad. We should be frightened of hell, and we should be frightened of Allah's wrath. I was nonplussed. So you think the play was good? Abba laughed. I didn't say that. I think there was something much worse than their attempts to scare people. Well, the message is all wrong, I started, collecting my thoughts. What they're teaching people is that they can do whatever they want to their whole lives, and all they have to do is say a prayer and they'll go to heaven. Abba nodded. Right. And what's wrong with that? What's the purpose of religion? The purpose of religion is to make good people and a good society. If people can do whatever they want, they will indulge their sinful desires and society will fall apart. They have a blank check to sin. Even Hitler could go to heaven just by accepting Jesus. Abba prompted me on, And that's why America is the way it is. Christians teach that there is no accountability for their deeds. Good, Berta. Very good. So when your friend at school asks you what you thought, make sure you share that with her. But don't leave her with just that. You need to sweep away falsehood with the truth. What is the truth about judgment? Allah judges us based on our choices in this world. Everything we do is recorded by angels, one on our right shoulder recording our good deeds, and one on our left shoulder recording our bad deeds. When we stand before Allah, our deeds will be read aloud. No one will be able to intercede for us, not our family, not Jesus, not even Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Allah will weigh our good deeds and our bad, and if our good deeds are greater than our bad deeds, Allah will give us paradise. What about Christians, Billu? Can Christians go to heaven? Yes, the Quran says that if Christians and Jews believe in one God and do good deeds, they can go to heaven. I was referring to a Quranic verse that is a point of controversy among Muslims. Some Muslims argue that this verse was abrogated by a later Quranic verse that says, if someone comes to Allah with a religion other than Islam, it will not be accepted from him. Other Muslims, our Jamaat among them, reconcile the two verses by arguing that Islam here does not refer to the faith system, but to the broader meaning of the word peace. The latter interpretation is obviously more tenuous, but only if one believes in the doctrine of abrogation. Surah 2, verse 116, and Surah 16, verse 101 of the Quran, both apparently teach that Allah can cancel older sections of the Quran with newer ones. Traditionally, Muslims developed a field of Quranic exegesis called the Abrogator and the Abrogated, in which they strove to determine the criteria and history of Quranic abrogation. Some Muslim scholars taught that up to 500 verses of the Quran no longer apply because later verses abrogated them. Other Muslim scholars taught that as few as 5 verses were abrogated. Regardless of the exact number, most orthodox sects of Islam believe in the doctrine of abrogation. A few Muslims dissent on this view, and the Ahmadi Jamaat is among them. These Muslims argue that if any part of the Quran could be cancelled, then it would not be the eternal word of God. They resort instead to harmonization of apparently abrogated verses, like the tenuous interpretation above. The difficulty for this view, though, is that the hadith are full of accounts of abrogation. But I didn't know these things at the time. All I knew is what our Jamaat taught about salvation, and that anyone who believed in one God could go to heaven, as at least one verse of the Quran clearly stated. And how many gods do Christians believe in, Billu? Some believe in one, and some believe in 3. Yes, and the Quran says it would be better for them if they stopped saying 3. That is why I'm glad you're having these conversations with your friends. They at least need to hear that there is only one God. If you can bring them to Islam and Ahmadiyyat, that would be even better. Before wrapping up our conversation on salvation, he quickly added, but don't spend too much time with this girl. Girls are dangerous for you, especially at this age. You are like a fire, and they are like oil. Even if you are not attracted to each other, after time, just being close to each other causes you to start burning. That is how you were made. Okay, Abba, gosh, I got it. Can we talk about something else? Ummi and Abba were only too willing to give me the fire and oil talk. It served to remind me that, when the time was right, we would come together as a family and discuss whom I would like to marry. If I had a girl in mind, my parents would then talk to her parents and try to arrange the marriage. If not, my parents would find a suitable wife. I would not date anyone at all, let alone a Western girl. To do so would be to depart from tradition. Chapter 16. Treasured Traditions. Tradition is the outward structure of Islam, the body animated by the soul of Islamic teaching. It seeped into us through immersion in the Muslim lifestyle. Every single day was imbued with tradition. I strived to pray the Salat 5 times a day, recited many detailed du'as, followed intricate instruction for ceremonial washings, and regularly looked to Muhammad's example for guidance. More than 1 billion Muslims joined me in adherence to traditions, whether praying about whom to marry, determining the appropriate length of a beard, or deciding whether to wear gold. But these traditions did not come from the Quran. They are found in hadith. From marital rights to martial restrictions, commercial laws to civil suits, the vast majority of Sharia and the Islamic way of life is derived from the hadith. There is no overestimating the importance of hadith in the Islamic world. As Baji and I grew older, Ummi and Abba considered it very important that we learn hadith and their precepts. They often recited from hadith collections, urging us to memorize the Arabic and understand its meaning. The first time they asked us to memorize hadith was immediately after Maghrib prayer one evening, while our family was still on the prayer rugs. Berti, Berta, we want you to memorize this short hadith. Hazrat Umar narrates that Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Deeds are judged by their intentions." After we recited the Arabic a few times, Ummi and Abba were satisfied that we had it memorized. They asked us if we had any questions. I had a few. "Abba, what book of hadith does this one come from?" "This one comes from Sahih Bukhari. What can you tell us about Sahih Bukhari?" "It is the most trustworthy book of hadith, compiled by Imam Bukhari. The hadith were not collected into books until a long time after Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam's death. Many false hadiths had been fabricated, and it was difficult to determine which ones were accurate. Imam Bukhari sifted through 500,000 hadith and picked out the 5,000 most accurate." Ummi followed up, asking, "And how did he do that?" "When Imam Bukhari heard a hadith, he assessed whether the person telling the hadith was trustworthy or not. If he had a bad reputation, if he had ever gotten in trouble, or even if he treated animals poorly, Imam Bukhari ignored that hadith. If he found the person trustworthy, he would ask him from whom he heard the hadith, and who that person heard it from, and who that person heard it from, all the way back to Muhammad. Imam Bukhari assessed the reputation of each individual in the chain, and if they were all trustworthy, then Imam Bukhari recorded the hadith in his book." The chain of transmission was called the Isnad, and it was immeasurably important to classical Muslim scholars. Islam arose as an authority-based society. When they asked the question, "Is this hadith authentic?" they answered by deferring to the authorities who transmitted it. Without the Isnad, the hadith was considered worthless. Muslims put less stock into Sira literature than hadith, specifically because Sira does not record Isnad. Ummi continued, "Very good. Berti, what is the next most trustworthy book of hadith?" "I don't know, Ummi." Baji was now 18 years old and in college. She did not enjoy these detailed questions like she once had, but Ummi wouldn't let her off that easy. "Yes, you do. Chalo, just answer this one, and that will be it. What is next after Sahih Bukhari?" "Sahih Muslim?" "Shabash. Nabil, do you know any others?" "I know Sunan Abu Dawud, and I know that there are 6 that we consider authentic, and the rest are a mix of reliable and unreliable hadith. The 6 are called Sahih Sitta, and the first 3 are Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, and Sunan Abu Dawud." Abba continued the list for me. "And the other 3 are Sunan Tirmidhi, Sunan Ibn Majah, and Sunan Nisa'i. These are the best 6 books of hadith, but among them, Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim are the most trustworthy." Ummi quickly added, "But even the most accurate ones are the word of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, not the word of Allah. We must not equate the hadith to the Quran." I pushed on this clarification. "But if Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said it, don't we have to obey him?" Abba interjected, "Of course, but still, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is not God. The Quran is the only uncorrupted, perfect book in the world. The books of hadith are more like the Bible because they are the works of men. There is divine truth in them, but we have to be careful of corruption. We always have to check the truths we get from other sources against the Quran. Jallo, that's enough for tonight. Don't forget the hadith you learned today. We'll ask you to recite it tomorrow." I was very interested in the hadith, not so much in their content as much as in their history and the way Muslim scholars assess them. I wanted to become adept at recognizing authentic hadith from fabricated ones. I started asking Ummi and Abba more about the systems of grading hadith, and I quickly came against the boundaries of their knowledge in these matters. In order to learn more, I would have to wait until our next Jamaat gathering, when I could ask the experts about the right books to buy to find out more. It so happened that Ummi and Abba decided to go back to the United Kingdom during the upcoming summer to attend a Jamaat gathering. I decided to do some research while there. What I didn't plan, though, was to experience God in a very personal way. God was going to perform a miracle that changed my life forever. Chapter 17. Signs in the Sky. It was my first time back in Britain since we had moved to Connecticut 8 years prior. I could hardly contain my excitement. Abba didn't even have a chance to get us out of Heathrow Airport before I managed to get a bottle of Iron Brew and a bag of Hula Hoops crisps. We headed back to the Tilford countryside, the same site where we had attended the centenary 9 years earlier. As we drove past quaint English towns, I felt like I was taking a tour through my past. The narrow roads, clustered buildings, and smaller vehicles all brought back memories of a childhood I loved. Even the thought of English food didn't bother me. This Jamaat gathering was called Jalsa. Our family attended the United States Jalsa every year in Washington, D.C., and we usually attended the Canadian Jalsa as well. But the United Kingdom Jalsa was different. This is where the leader of our Jamaat lived, and it always felt special to be in his presence. Because of him, tens of thousands of Ahmadis attended the United Kingdom Jalsa. As much as I anticipated seeing him, the people I most longed for were my friends from Scotland, the Maliks. Apart from one letter that I received from the youngest brother while I was in seventh grade, I had not heard from any of them. Public email was still in its nascent phases, and international phone calls were too expensive to justify. But when I arrived at the Jalsa, I realized I didn't even know if my friends would be there. As special as the gathering was, there were myriad circumstances that could preclude their attendance. It would be nearly impossible to look for them by walking through the Jalsa, too. Apart from the sheer number of people to search through, we had all grown up over the previous 7 years, and I was not sure I would recognize them even if I saw them. I sorely wanted to reunite with them, but I didn't know where to start. So I turned to God. From a very early age, Ami had trained me to respond in dire moments with prayer, but I knew of no dua for finding people. I had memorized a prayer to recite when looking for lost items, but given that it was the same prayer we recite when we hear the news of someone's death, I decided it would not be apt for the occasion. Instead, I just prayed from my heart, bowing my head and closing my eyes. God, can you please help me find my friends? I had nothing else to say, so I said nothing else. When I opened my eyes, what I saw stunned me stock still. In the air before me were two streaks of color, one gold and one silver, as if whimsically painted onto the sky by an ethereal brush. They trailed into the distance, obviously leading me somewhere. I still remember the words I spoke in shock. You're kidding. I'm supposed to follow those, right? Whether I was speaking to God or myself, I'm not sure. What I intrinsically knew was that no one could see the stripes but me. They were not so much in the sky as they were in my perception of the sky. They were neither a mile away, nor a foot away, nor anywhere in between. They just were, and they were waiting for me. The Jalsa was crowded, and everyone was outside the tents because there was no speech currently in session. I followed the streaks into swarms of people, sifting my way through the crowd as if in a Pakistani bazaar. And in fact, the streaks swirled over the Jalsa marketplace, the same area where I wanted to go for a badge almost a decade prior. This time, I was not interrupted by a surly senior citizen. Instead, the streaks funneled downward, dissipating over a space next to a clothing tent. When I weeded my way to the clearing, I saw two men standing there, chatting and trying on skullcaps. It took me a moment, but I recognized them. They were the older Malik brothers. I ran to them and grasped them. When they recognized me, we rejoiced together. They were incredulous at my height, incessantly repeating, "You are just a wee boy!" And so they dragged me through the Jalsa, reintroducing me to everyone from Glasgow whom I once knew. We were overjoyed. For the time being, the streaks in the sky were forgotten. Later that evening, as I considered the day's events while lying in bed, I could not get past the gold and silver streaks. To me, there was nothing else for it. They meant God must exist. Of course, I already believed that God existed. I had seen answered prayers, prophetic dreams, and rational argumentation pointing toward the existence of God, but there was always room for doubt. Perhaps the answered prayers were coincidence, or maybe the prophetic dreams were exaggerated over time to fit reality, or it was possible that there were flaws in the logic of the arguments. Sure, I was 99% certain that God existed, but that shadow of doubt was always there. But now, there was no remotely plausible alternative. How else could I explain what happened that day? I had no idea where my friends were, and when I prayed, I was supernaturally led to them. I began to consider alternative explanations. Maybe I had imagined the streaks? No, that couldn't work because I went straight to my friends. Maybe I subconsciously knew where my friends were. No, that was impossible. I didn't know if they were even at the Jalsa, let alone at the exact spot in the marketplace. Perhaps, while I lived in Scotland, I developed extrasensory connections with my friends that remained dormant until I called on them that afternoon, whereupon our psychic bonds were able to manifest themselves in my visual sensorium. Honestly, that was the best naturalistic explanation I could come up with. But not only did it skirt the boundaries of naturalism, it totally blew past the boundaries of plausibility. No, I told myself, there is no alternative. God is real, and he hears my prayers, even the little ones, like wanting to know where my friends are. That day, I no longer just believed that God was real. I knew God was real, and I knew God cared for me. The timing could not have been better. When I returned to Princess Anne for my junior year, one of my mandatory classes was Theory of Knowledge, and it served as an introductory course to general philosophy and epistemology. Our textbook was called Man is the Measure, and one of the first discussions we had in class was, how can we know whether God exists? The discussions were deep and shook the faith of many theists in the class. Although our conversations focused on objective argumentation, as they should have, I came to realize that subjective knowledge can be far more powerful. I would never be able to convince anyone that I actually saw the streaks in the sky, or that they actually led me to my friends. But I did not need to. It was a sign for me, and I went from being 99% sure that God exists to 100% certain. 4 years later, when my world started falling apart, that 1% made all the difference. Chapter 18. Honor and Authority. Theory of Knowledge was one of the many classes that I had with my best friend, David. We had grown closer and closer since seventh grade, and by the time we were upperclassmen, we were inseparable. We had 6 of our 7 classes together, became co-captains of the academic trivia team, and entered into the forensics team as a duo. David and I won 5th place in the state competition our junior year, surprising everyone because we were both rookies. During senior year, we won the state championship. David and I had a few discussions about religion and the existence of God. He and I did not see eye to eye, and it was clear that our upbringing had a lot to do with it. He was hesitant to move past agnosticism, and my starting point was Islam. The discussions in Theory of Knowledge seemed to bolster his hesitance, and although it did not shake my conviction in God's existence, it did bring some critical differences between Eastern and Western cultures into sharp relief. When my parents taught me to examine my beliefs, I was essentially expected to build a defense for what they had taught me. In Theory of Knowledge, we were ostensibly doing the same, examining our beliefs, but in practice, it was the exact opposite. We were critically probing our beliefs, challenging them, testing them for weak points, pliability, and boundaries. Some students were even replacing them. This difference between Eastern and Western education can be traced to the disparity that divides Muslim immigrants from their children. Islamic cultures tend to establish people of high status as authorities, whereas the authority in Western culture is reason itself. These alternative seats of authority permeate the mind, determining the moral outlook of whole societies. When authority is derived from position rather than reason, the act of questioning leadership is dangerous because it has the potential to upset the system. Dissension is reprimanded and obedience is rewarded. Correct and incorrect courses of action are assessed socially, not individually. A person's virtue is thus determined by how well he meets social expectations, not by an individual determination of right and wrong. Thus, positional authority yields a society that determines right and wrong based on honor and shame. On the other hand, when authority is derived from reason, questions are welcome because critical examination sharpens the very basis of authority. Each person is expected to critically examine his own course of action. Correct and incorrect courses of action are assessed individually. A person's virtue is determined by whether he does what he knows to be right or wrong. Thus, rational authority creates a society that determines right and wrong based on innocence and guilt. Much of the West's inability to understand the East stems from the paradigmatic schism between honor-shame cultures and innocence-guilt cultures. Of course, the matter is quite complex, and elements of both paradigms are present in the East and the West, but the honor-shame spectrum is the operative paradigm that drives the East, and it is hard for Westerners to understand. This reliance on positional authority explains some characteristics in parts of the Muslim world that confound many Westerners, such as the continued practices of honor killings, child brides of six or younger, and blood feuds. For one reason or another, the prevailing sources of social authority in these regions deem these customs acceptable, perhaps even preferable. No amount of sheer reason is going to change these practices, nor will externally imposed prohibitions. The change will have to be social, internal, and organic. But honor killings and blood feuds are generally not struggles for children raised as second-generation Western Muslims. We wrestle with the honor-shame principle that tells us, it's okay as long as you don't get caught. If there is no dishonor, it's not wrong. I saw this principle play out many times while I was growing up, though I'm obliged to share only innocuous accounts. The most innocent one I can think of has to do with free refills. Many of my Muslim friends thought it perfectly acceptable to order water from fast food restaurants and then go to the dispenser and fill up on soda. We rarely blinked an eye at this, and I myself did it regularly. But at a Taco Bell in Virginia one day, one of my friends was caught getting Mountain Dew Code Red instead of water. A young employee had glanced over the counter and seen my friend filling up on soda. Without much tact, he pushed my friend's hand away from the fountain drinks and said loudly, "You ordered water, you can't get soda." At this, many people turned to see the commotion, and my friend immediately blushed. It was obvious the employee was correct, since the cups for water were transparent and the cups for soda were opaque. The employee caught him literally red-handed. The soda was clearly visible to all. For my friend, this was the moment that made his actions a poor choice. He had suffered dishonor in front of many. Stealing the soda was not an issue for him before being caught. In fact, it was still not the issue after being caught. As strange as it might sound to Westerners, it was more dishonorable for him to be called out by a minimum wage employee than to be caught stealing soda. So he denied it, asserting firmly, "I am getting water." He filled the rest of his cup with water and walked away from the counter as if it were perfectly normal for water to be a deep, bubbly pink. On another occasion, one of my cousins was receiving some light-hearted ridicule from the rest of my family for having been caught committing minor insurance fraud. To help alleviate the shame, my cousin turned it into a funny story for us all. He started by telling us that, as he was getting quotes for auto insurance, he found he would save a lot of money if he lied and told the insurance companies he was married. So he made up a long backstory about meeting his wife, what she did for a living, and even the mnemonic he used to remember her birthday. He planned to tell the agent that he unfortunately did not have any papers since she was still in Pakistan. When he had invented enough details, he called a company, convinced them he was married, and secured the lower rate. Only one other family member and I chided him for this, and we were both American-born. The elders laughed and told us to lighten up, asserting that the insurance companies had enough money as it was. My cousin boisterously agreed. As the story went, over a year later, he had a fender bender and needed to make a roadside claim. While sharing details of the accident on the phone, the insurance agent asked him if he was with his wife. His mind on the accident, he responded that he did not have a wife. Unfazed, the agent asked him if he had ever been married, and my cousin replied, no. Shortly thereafter, my cousin received an adjusted insurance rate well over twice what he had been paying. By the time the story was through, the family was roaring with laughter. For having told such a good story, he was able to transform the shame of being caught lying into the honor of being a good storyteller. Actually doing the right thing didn't even enter into the equation, and neither did guilt. These are relatively harmless examples of how an honor-shame culture might see things differently from a Western culture of guilt and innocence. Of course, there is a highly developed notion of morality in Islam, so we must take care not to oversimplify the matter and assume that Muslims do whatever they wish if they believe they will not be caught. All the same, it is safe to say that guilt is less of a determining factor in the East than is shame. Coming back to second-generation Muslim Westerners, it might now be easier to see just how difficult it can be to straddle these two cultures. When engaged in something less than socially acceptable, the young Muslim will be tempted to hide it and will begin to struggle with internal guilt. The natural Eastern tendency to hide shameful truths exacerbates the Western tendency to feel guilty. For me, this became a major problem as I progressed through high school. All my friends knew that I was a Muslim and that I was not allowed to date. I had done my best to be an ambassador for my culture by telling others I was happy about the idea of an arranged marriage. And it truly didn't bother me, until I started developing a real interest in girls. In my senior year, I developed a crush on a girl who also confessed she was interested in me. By anyone's standards in the West, it was a very innocent relationship, holding hands and speaking romantic words. But still, I kept it secret because it went against my Eastern standards, and I felt very guilty. I called it off after a matter of weeks, even though I still had feelings for her. Not long after, she started dating my best friend, David. My feelings for her were unabated, and after a while, I felt very guilty for having a crush on my best friend's girlfriend. I confessed to David that I had had a secret relationship with her before they started dating, and that I still had feelings for her. None of my best friends understood why I had hid this from them, least of all David. From his perspective, I had utterly betrayed him by not being open with him and for harboring feelings for his girlfriend. There was a falling out between David and me just days before graduation, with everyone on one side and me on the other. Once again, I was friendless. But this time, I was deeply hurt and utterly confused. What had happened? Why did I always end up alone? I knew I had done something wrong, but was it so wrong that I deserved to lose all of my friends? I went to no graduation parties, I was no longer invited to any of the pre-college trips we had planned, and I was unable to reunite with everyone when they returned home for breaks. Had I understood the way I was acting at the time, I might have done things differently. Had they understood me, they might have been less hurt by my secrets. Had we only known, I might still have my childhood friends today. Some believe that cultural differences between East and West do not exist, that people all see the world the same way. Others consider the Eastern and Western paradigms as a curiosity to consider. But for me, and for others like me, the schism between East and West shapes the very course of our lives. Because of it, I had no friends in my early childhood, and because of it, I was launched into adulthood alone once more. Thankfully, the worst of the pain lasted only the summer. I started college a few months later, in August of 2001, looking forward to the prospect of reinventing myself and finding new friends. But just 3 weeks into college, a new crisis hit, and this one affected our entire nation. The world would never be the same again. Chapter 19. The Religion of Peace. It was the beginning of my fourth week at Old Dominion University. Baji and I both attended ODU for the same reason. It was the best school close to home, and Ami and Abba would not let us go any further. We often went to school together, but on Tuesday mornings, Baji would come after me to avoid waiting in traffic. I had to be at my anatomy lab by 8 o'clock. That Tuesday morning started like any other. I finished in the anatomy lab at 10:30 and headed toward Webb Center, the student union at ODU. I was free until the afternoon, when the forensics team met for practice. I had joined the team the first week of school and was excited to see if I could carry my high school success into college. As I strolled through the entrance of the student union, the captain of the forensics team strode out hurriedly. I had no idea anything was amiss, so I asked, "What's going on?" Without stopping, she said, "The second tower just came down." Confused, I saw a crowd by the televisions in the lounge behind her, so I made my way there. The news stations were playing and replaying footage of the North and South Towers of the World Trade Center collapsing. Over and over, they played the images of a plane crashing into one of the towers, and each tower successively crumbling. It felt like a scene out of a movie, but we were transfixed by a very real horror. No one moved, and no one spoke. After a few moments, my phone rang. It was Abba, his voice uncharacteristically pressured. "Nabil, where are you? Why haven't you been picking up your phone?" "I'm at school, Abba. I didn't have reception in the anatomy lab." "Come home now. Is Baji with you?" "No, is she okay?" "She's not picking up her phone either. Find her and come home right away." Still reeling from the previous few minutes, I tried to fit the pieces together. "Abba, what's wrong? Why do I have to come home?" Surprised, Abba asked, "Don't you know? There has been an attack." "Yes, but why does that mean I have to come home?" "Nabil, they're blaming Muslims. People will be emotional, and they could take it out on you or Baji. It's your job to find her. Make sure she's safe and come home." "But Abba, I..." Abba wasted no more time. "Nabil, do as I say. I have to call Baji. Keep your phone close." With that, he hung up. I looked around at the people watching the televisions. Were these people my enemies? Could they really want to hurt me? Slowly, the danger shifted from being on the television to being all around me. I was now a part of this macabre movie, and I had a role to play. I left quickly and called Baji. To my great relief, she picked up. "Assalamu alaikum." "Baji, do you know what's going on? Where are you?" "Yes, I'm in my car. I'm going home." "Why weren't you picking up your phone when Abba called?" "I was at 7-Eleven watching the TV, and a policeman pulled me aside. He told me it might not be safe to stay out because I'm wearing a burqa. He offered to escort me back to my car, and now I'm going home."
"Really? That was nice of him. Okay, drive safely. I'll see you at home soon."
For the rest of the day, we stayed glued to the television. Abba made arrangements to take the week off, and he told us to do the same. We left the home only to buy American flags, which were quickly selling out. We displayed flags prominently on each car and in our yard, and we kept a few in the garage just in case. We wanted people to know that we weren't the enemy, no matter what they were hearing on the news. This was not paranoia on my father's part. During Operation Desert Storm, members of my family had been targeted and victimized. Naniyami was refused service at a gas station in New York because she wore a burqa. Naniyami, my sweet little grandmother. A distant aunt of ours had been assaulted in a parking lot, punched in the stomach while getting groceries. Indeed, not long after the September 11th attacks, the mosque that sat at the outskirts of ODU was vandalized, all of its windows broken. I knew the people who paid to repair the mosque. They were good, hard-working people. As the days progressed, it became clear that the hijackers were indeed Muslim, and that this attack on our nation had been carried out in the name of Islam. But what Islam was this? It was clearly not the Islam I knew. True, I used to hear of Muslims in distant lands committing atrocities in the name of Allah, but those accounts were too remote to create any cognitive dissonance. This hit much closer to home. This hit us in our hearts. Over the following weeks, news stations mercilessly looped footage of the crumbling towers. Again and again and again, I witnessed thousands of innocents being massacred in the name of my God. It finally became too much. I had to learn the truth about my faith once and for all. I had to figure out how to reconcile my Islam, a religion of peace, with the Islam on television, a religion of terror. In the 12 years since that day, I have learned that the question is far more complex than it appears. The most important consideration is the definition of Islam. If by Islam we mean the beliefs of Muslims, then Islam can be a religion of peace or a religion of terror, depending on how it is taught. In the West, Muslims are generally taught a very pacific version of Islam. Just like Baji and I, Western Muslims are taught that Muhammad fought only defensive battles and that violent verses in the Quran refer to specific, defensive contexts. Jihad is here defined as primarily a peaceful endeavor, an internal struggle against one's own baser desires. When asked about their religion, Western Muslims honestly report what they believe. Islam is a religion of peace. In the East, though, Muslims often have a less docile view of Islam. They are taught that Islam is superior to all other religions and ways of life, and that Allah wishes to see it established throughout the world. They often define jihad as a primarily physical endeavor, a struggle against the enemies of Islam. When asked about their religion, these Muslims will honestly report what they believe. Islam will dominate the world. So if we define Islam by the beliefs of its adherents, it may or may not be a religion of peace. But if we define Islam more traditionally, as the system of beliefs and practices taught by Muhammad, then the answer is less ambiguous. The earliest historical records show that Muhammad launched offensive military campaigns and used violence at times to accomplish his purposes. He used the term jihad in both spiritual and physical contexts. But the physical jihad is the one that Muhammad strongly emphasizes. The peaceful practice of Islam hinges on later, often Western interpretations of Muhammad's teachings, whereas the more violent variations of Islam are deeply rooted in orthodoxy and history. Of course, like all people, Muslims in the East and West generally just believe what they are taught. Rarely is there much critical investigation into historical events, and the few that invest the effort usually do the same thing that I had done in my theory of knowledge class. Attempt to defend what is already believed, potentially ignoring or underestimating evidence that points to the contrary. This is only natural, since it is extremely difficult to change beliefs that are dear to the heart. Such was the case with me. In my heart of hearts, I wanted to know the truth about Islam, but it would be nearly impossible to challenge my childhood beliefs just by investigating them. I would keep finding ways to ignore difficult truths. What I needed was something that would not let me get away with my biases.
I needed something that would mercilessly loop my bad arguments before my eyes, again and again and again, until I could avoid them no longer. I needed a friend, an intelligent, uncompromising, non-Muslim friend who would be willing to challenge me. Of course, not only would he have to be bold and stubborn enough to deal with the likes of me, but I would have to like and trust him enough to dialogue with him about the things that mattered to me most. Little did I know, God had already introduced us, and I was already on a path that would change my life forever. Part 3. Testing the New Testament. Oh Allah, the Bible couldn't be right, could it? Chapter 20. Becoming Brothers. There is a simple reason I never listened to street preachers. They didn't seem to care about me. It wasn't that they were annoying. I found their passion admirable, and I appreciated people who stood up for what they believed. Rather, it was that they treated me like an object of their agenda. Did they have any idea how their message would impact my life? Did they even care? Sure, there are street preachers who share their message while still greeting people kindly, getting to know others' troubles, and praying over personal pains, but I never saw them. What I saw were men who would stand on street corners accosting the public with their beliefs. No doubt they reached a few, but they repelled many more. Unfortunately, I've found that many Christians think of evangelism the same way, foisting Christian beliefs on strangers in chance encounters. The problem with this approach is that the gospel requires a radical life change, and not many people are about to listen to strangers telling them to change the way they live. What do they know about others' lives? On the other hand, if a true friend shares the exact same message with heartfelt sincerity, speaking to specific circumstances and struggles, then the message is heard loud and clear. Effective evangelism requires relationships. There are very few exceptions. In my case, I knew of no Christian who truly cared about me, no one who had been a part of my life through thick and thin. I had plenty of Christian acquaintances, and I'm sure they would have been my friends if I had become a Christian, but that kind of friendship is conditional. There were none that I knew who cared about me unconditionally. Since no Christian cared about me, I did not care about their message. But that was about to change. It took a few weeks after 9/11 for life to regain a semblance of normalcy. Baji and I started attending classes again, Abba was back at work, and Ummi felt safe enough to run errands. Although Islam was still in the hot seat on the news and a general mistrust of Muslims still hung in the air, the wave of emotional attacks was not as bad as we had expected. True, our community mosque was vandalized, and we frequently heard of anti-Muslim sentiments, but we knew of no physical attacks against Muslims. We felt safe to return to our lives, and not a moment too soon. The first forensics tournament of the year was upon us. Unlike the tournaments in high school, collegiate forensics tournaments were multi-day affairs, often in other states. Our team's first tournament was slated for Westchester, Pennsylvania. On the day of our departure, Ummi decided to drive me to ODU so she could see me off. When we arrived at the Baton Arts and Letters building, one of the other students on the forensics team came out to greet us. I had spoken with him a few times at practice, but we were still getting to know each other. He rushed over to us and started helping with my bags while introducing himself to Ummi. "Hi, Mrs. Qureshi. I'm David Wood." Ummi was glad to meet someone from the team before sending me off to who knows where. "Hello, David. Very nice to meet you. Are you going with Nabil on this trip?" "Yeah, he told me he might be concerned, but we'll take good care of him, don't worry." Nothing David could have said would have made Ummi any happier. "Nabil, I can tell this is a good boy. Stay close to him." "Acha, Ummi, I will." "Keep your phone on you, okay, Nabil? Call me when you get to your hotel so I know you're safe, and so you can give me your hotel room number." "Acha, Ummi, I will. I'll be okay, don't worry." Telling Ummi not to worry was like telling her not to breathe, so she just ignored me. "And don't forget to call Abba too, so he knows you're okay. Acha, Ummi." Ummi then looked to David. "Remind Nabil to call us. He's very forgetful." David couldn't hide his smile. "Oh, I'll make sure of it." Ummi was finally satisfied. "Thank you, David. I'm so glad I got to meet one of Nabil's friends. After the trip, you should come over to our house for a meal. I'll cook you real Pakistani food." There was no hesitation in David's voice. "You don't have to say that twice. Thanks, Mrs. Qureshi." "Okay, boys, have fun. Be good, Nabil, call me, and don't forget to pray the Salat." Ummi took my face in both her hands and kissed me on the cheek, just as she used to do when I was 4 years old, except now I was the one bending over. David was almost beside himself with repressed glee, expecting me to be embarrassed by Ami's show of affection. But this was normal for our family, and I rather enjoyed receiving this much love from her. As she started to get back in her car, she called out a traditional Pakistani valediction. Khuda hafiz, Berta. May God protect you. Khuda hafiz, Ami. Love you. As she drove out of the parking lot, David just stared at me, a comical smile painted on his face. What? Oh, nothing, nothing. She does know you'll be gone for just 3 days, right? Yeah, but I don't leave home very often. I picked up some bags and started walking into the building to meet our team. Uh-huh. David picked up the rest of the bags and followed, his silly smile unrelenting. Hey, you know what? It's been a while since you talked to your mother. You really should call her. I stopped and glared at David, and then turned around and looked at the main road. Ami was still there, waiting at a red light to take a left turn. She was watching us walk into the building. Out of playful spite, I turned back to David and said, You know what? I will. Thanks, David, for your heartfelt concern about my relationship with my mother. I pulled out my cell phone and called Ami. David chuckled to himself. And so our friendship was off to a flying start, skipping right past the niceties and straight into brotherly teasing. In the days to come, many would comment that David and I were foils of one another. We were both exactly the same height, 6'3", but I had dark skin and black hair, while David had light skin and blonde hair. I was a slender 175 pounds, while David easily had 40 pounds of muscle over me. I was very meticulous with my appearance and image, while David preferred jeans and t-shirts. I had a pampered childhood, while David came out of trailer parks in a gritty past. But what I did not know about David was to be the starkest contrast of all. David was a Christian with strong convictions who had spent the previous 5 years of his life studying the Bible and learning to follow Jesus. Even though the gospel was his passion, he did not bombard me with his beliefs straight away. The discussions arose much more naturally, after we became friends, and in the context of a life lived together. In fact, I was the one who brought it up. Chapter 21. Opening My Eyes. The trip up to Westchester was a blast. All the teammates were getting to know one another, practicing their forensics pieces, sharing life stories, and just laughing together. It was a very eye-opening experience for me, since it was my first time becoming intimately acquainted with people who had widely divergent lifestyles and thoughts. One girl on the team advocated legalizing drugs. One of the boys lived with his girlfriend, and another boy lived with his boyfriend. Welcome to college, I thought. We stopped for dinner at an Italian restaurant in Maryland. After the staff arranged a table large enough for all of us, they sat us down next to the kitchen where we had a clear view of all the cooks. David and I spent the past few hours getting to know more about each other. We decided to sit together over dinner and split a pizza. David can read people pretty well, and he quickly realized that I do not get offended by playful comments. Far from it, I always appreciate when people let down their guard with me and speak completely unfiltered. Political correctness is for acquaintances, not friends. So as we read through the menu, he turned to me with mock concern and said, Nabil, since you're probably feeling homesick, I was looking for a pizza that might cheer you up. But they only have a Mediterranean pizza, not Middle Eastern pizza. Unfazed, I replied, but lucky for you, they do have a white pizza. My guess is that it'll be bland and tasteless. You'll love it. David laughed. Hear on. I hope this place is authentic. There's a way to test that, you know. Oh, yeah? Yeah, watch this. With that, David turned to the kitchen and yelled, Hey, Tony! Immediately, three of the cooks looked over at us, and we started laughing hysterically. David, next time you pull a stunt like that, wait until after they've made our food. So the night continued in lighthearted frivolity. When we finally made it to the hotel, our coach told us there were two rooms to be shared among the four guys on the trip. It was a no-brainer for us, and before long, David and I were getting settled. The rest of the team wanted to go out and celebrate. Most members left to go drinking or dancing at a nearby bar, while some of the others were looking for a suitable place to smoke various things. I had never engaged in any of these activities, and I was not looking to start. David also decided against joining them, which intrigued me. I wondered what made him different from the rest of the team, more like me. I did not have to wait long to find out. While I was unpacking, David sat down in an armchair in the corner of the room and kicked up his feet. He pulled out his Bible and started reading. It's difficult to express just how flabbergasted I was by this. Never in my life had I seen anyone read a Bible in his free time. In fact, I hadn't even heard of this happening. True, I knew Christians revered the Bible, but I figured they all knew in their hearts that it had been changed over time, and there was no point in reading it. So in the same moment I found out David was a Christian, I also concluded that he must be especially deluded.